This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. If you heard our show last Wednesday, we are taking a look at just how different the world is today from what it was just 1 year ago. And it's remarkable how quickly events are moving, not just splashy events or interesting events, but prophetically significant events, world events that are moving the world forward in terms of the fulfillment of biblical prophecies. And we're looking at the world region by region. And with each region, we're answering two big questions. First, what was the biggest change in this region over the past year? And second, what's the biggest change we should watch for in the coming year? In the studio, we have a record number of our writing staff. We have Brent Nachtigall.
Greetings.
Robert Morley.
Nice to be here.
Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello.
Anthony Chibaderwe.
Hello.
And via Skype from our office in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And at the end of the program, we're going to bring in our social media manager, David Vigil, for a little bit of a look at how the work has changed over 2015, this program and the work of the Philadelphia Church of God. Well, last week, we looked specifically at the Middle East and Europe. Today, we're going to focus on Asia and Anglo-America. So the first region we look at is Asia. I'll give you, Jeremiah, 8 minutes or so to answer the question, what was the biggest change in Asia over the past year?
Well, to put it in one sentence, it would be in 2015, Russia and China grew bolder in their push against America's global leadership. And a big part of this emboldening happened in the way that these two massive powerhouse nations just showed time and again that they have each other's backs against this push against the global order. But it's probably easiest to see the overall trend if we talk about Russia and then China separately. So with Russia, it's actually impossible to review 2015 without putting it in the context of the very pivotal 2014 that happened just before it. 2014, Russian President Vladimir Putin just shocked the world by breaking Europe's post-war order and annexing the Crimean Peninsula from Ukraine. And so by making this peninsula part of Russia, Putin effectively redrew the map of Europe and just really alarmed the Western world. And then just after that, he invaded eastern Ukraine, partly with his little green men, which were later revealed to be the Russian special forces. So when 2015 began, it seemed like Russia was essentially trying to just hold on to those gains that it had made in 2014, despite some pretty heavy sanctions that were levied on Russia from Western nations. And these sanctions, it's important to keep in mind that they were not insignificant, you know, just kind of a minor inconvenience for Russia. European powers stayed fairly united against Moscow on these sanctions. The sanctions regime held firm, and the Russian economy started to really tank throughout 2015. Yet, Vladimir Putin continued to garner these sky-high approval ratings among his people, soaring into the low 90s, just this kind of a level of approval that most Western leaders could only dream of having with their people. And so the Russians, really with that approval, they were just showing the world that they were excited to be viewed as a world power once again, and they were willing to withstand some economic suffering if that's what it took for Russia to once again become a major world power, and if that's what it took for America's influence to begin to be eroded. So that's essentially how the first half of the year of 2015 played out for Russia. But then something quite unexpected happened. And we talked about this a bit last week on the program in the Middle East section. That was Putin launched an unprecedented military intervention in Syria. This actually happened in September 2015. That's when it began, so a little more than halfway through the year. But it had a lot of pundits and analysts scratching their heads. You know, what is Putin thinking? What does he want? Sure, Assad is a key ally for Putin. Sure, Assad guarantees the survival of Russia's only Mediterranean naval port there at Tartus. But this intervention came during a time of $40 per barrel oil, just terribly low prices that were hurting Russia's economy in all kinds of ways. And they came during the time when these Western sanctions were really taking hold on Europe's economy. The data for 2015 is still coming in, but it looks like Russia's economy shrunk almost 4% for the year. Very serious situation there. And it also suffered about a 15% inflation rate and a greatly eroded ruble. So that economic turmoil there was not at all insignificant. Yet, despite all of this, Putin launched those Syria campaigns. And the reason why, I believe, shows that it sort of points to the fact that in 2016, Russia will probably be even more ambitious and even more willing to take major risks than he was in 2015 and possibly even than he was in 2014. So Putin waged those campaigns largely because he saw that America was retreating from the Middle East. He couldn't resist the window that it presented for him to simultaneously show the world that the Russian Federation is a mighty power and to show the world that the United States is no longer the go-to global policeman, the only power with any real authority for international conflicts. And so the move also gave him a chance to demonstrate to his allies and nations who he hopes will become his allies that Russia, unlike America, will stand resolutely by its friends. So this really strikes at the heart of Putin's whole modus operandi. Sometimes it's difficult to discern the exact motives behind his specific behaviors and why he's willing to maintain a course of action that leads to pretty serious economic suffering for his people. But the thing that Putin's track record shows to be consistently true is that he is bent on demonstrating that Russia is mighty and that he respects power and that he will take advantage of weakness. And so
his people certainly seem to appreciate that as well.
They really do. They really do. There's no other explanation for the fact that their ruble is, you know, growing smaller and smaller in terms of purchasing power and whatnot. Yet their approval for their president just keeps on going through the roof. One fascinating trend that fed into this larger trend in Russia during 2015 was the anti-America propaganda. The state-controlled media paint just all kinds of events as America-orchestrated conspiracies designed to erode or just undermine Russia. And so the pro-Western change in Ukraine in late 2013, that was all America's fault. This is what the Russian media say. That was America, just sort of a U.S. plot to undermine Russia. And this is just the propaganda machine during 2015 was so well-oiled. It pinned the blame for Europe's migrant crisis on America. It pinned the blame for the Charlie Hebdo attacks at the beginning of the year on America. Just all kinds of bizarre and totally unsubstantiated things that more and more Russians are beginning to believe because they're fed this, they're spoon-fed this propaganda night and day.
Although I'd have to say that I think you could make a pretty strong case about America's responsibility for some of the migrant crisis, or maybe a good degree of the migrant crisis, considering it's Syria that is the source of so much of those refugees, and it was the United States that kind of paved the way for that. Not that it matters too much, but the point being that the Russians are really viewing this almost as a kind of resurrection of Cold War era politics globally.
That's true. That's true. And they do, anytime there's a vestige of truth in a story like that, they really run with that, expand it, and inflate it. And in many cases, the U.S. is certainly not faultless in a lot of the turmoil that's erupting in all these various pockets around the world. But this propaganda just provides Putin with a really nasty enemy that helps to legitimize him and paint him as this great savior of Mother Russia. So it's worked very powerfully to his advantage. And another key aspect of this trend has been that Putin's ambition is frightening Europe. It's reopening the topic of European security, which many Western nations, including the United States, believe to have been closed back when the Cold War ended. But now you've got, the Baltic nations are petitioning for permanent deployment of NATO forces there in Lithuania and Latvia and Estonia. You've got Sweden contemplating joining NATO suddenly. You've got European defense spending, which had been shrinking for about a decade or more, suddenly it's expanding. It's rising once again.
So really an intensification of a trend that we've seen really for 10, 11 years as Putin has really come on strong within Russia, and the response, the knock-on effect in Europe as a result of that. So you mentioned at the beginning, this is the overarching trend is Russia and China in becoming more bold as a result of America's weakening international influence. Very quickly, just a sense of how the world is different now in terms of China's power than it was a year ago.
Okay, sure. Yeah, with China, the most stark indication of the fact that China is following Russia's lead in just pushing against the U.S. order, even redrawing the map of the world, is in the artificial islands that it's created in the South China Sea. These are seven different reefs that were partially or wholly submerged, and they've devoted millions, possibly billions, to dredging up earth to turn these into viable islands. They pave over them. Then they turn them into military installations and say, from now on, this is part of China. And in many cases, this is 800 miles from the Chinese mainland, just far outside of what the United Nations says is part of a country's exclusive economic zone. And in a few cases, they're well within the exclusive economic zone of other nations like the Philippines. So it's an incredibly pushy, aggressive move that says we essentially own all of the South China Sea, which is a very highly trafficked sea in terms of global trade. It's potentially very resource rich. So the fact that China has staked a claim to this by building these islands just shows that they're not afraid of the U.S. or anyone. They don't perceive that there's another power on the scene right now that will confront them, even when they make these just audacious claims about owning, you know, half of the the entire South China Sea there, or actually more like 90% of it. So I think this just shows that that China is engaged in a campaign to create a whole chain of air and sea capable fortresses, and that it is just bent on expanding Chinese power and as congealing its identity sort of as a real powerhouse.
You know, this I think you're dead on right that this is really the big story, the way that the world has changed and Asia has changed in 2015. I think this is one of the strongest effects of America's weakness on the world. And this is a strong evidence of something that we've been talking about for quite some time, about what happens in a post-American world. As American influence declines, who fills the void? And really, in no other region in the world do you see the kind of aggressive moves that you see coming out of these Asian powers in quite the same way. I mean, we could talk about terrorist groups in the Middle East. We can talk about Iran, but we're talking about great powers. We're talking about huge nations with a lot of pull. We're talking about a nuclear power in Russia. We're talking about a nation with 1.6 billion people in China, and they're really taking the fight to America and really extending their power in some very dramatic ways.
Yeah, that's right. And really, these islands, you know, they're just a few square miles of turf that's actually been created, but they provide kind of a maritime microcosm of China's actions as a whole during 2015. They show that Beijing, just like Russia, wants to change the international order. China is tired of the era of U.S. global rule, and they're pushing against it. They're eager to be recognized as a power in their own right. And we also saw China openly challenge America by establishing the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank.
Yeah, I'd like to bring Robert in on this, because another one of the huge moves that we see coming out of China is its economic moves that it's taking in light of American weakness, especially economic weakness.
Absolutely. China did, as you mentioned, Jeremiah, there just lead the way in the establishment of this very anti-American international investment bank. It went out of its way to even recruit American allies to join this bank that the United States saw as a threat to the American-dominated World Bank and International Monetary Fund institutions that the United States uses to project its power, its financial power and economic power around the world to accomplish its goals. And here we had China this year establish this bank and gain incredible support from even America's closest allies that America worked very hard to dissuade from joining this adventure that China has initiated. And we are now seeing the first steps taking place by China through this bank to start influencing nations around the world. We're seeing it focus on Southeast Asia and Africa, and we're going to see more of it coming into direct competition with the United States.
Yeah, that's very true. I would also just say that we have to be careful not to understate some of the troubles that China faced in 2015. The stock market meltdown that happened there, it was called Black Monday, and it was a fairly significant economic event for that, you know, massive nation. And it shows that China's economy is fragile in some ways, and that the stellar growth that China has been able to maintain year after year for the last decade or much longer may not be sustainable under the current model of everything it's doing. But in a way, though, I think that these economic troubles at home for China could likely lead to a China that's even more aggressive abroad. And that is, it's kind of a tried and true technique for China to quell domestic unrest, domestic questioning of the Communist Party by stirring up feelings of patriotism among the people. And so how do you do that? You push against something outside of the country. You stir up a conflict here, a conflict there, and suddenly it's unpatriotic to be talking badly about the Chinese government during a time of, you know, a time that borders on war or could escalate into war. So it's something that we've seen in the past with China and other nations, just sort of a distraction technique. So I just wonder if the fact that the economy is rickety in some ways could prompt the leadership to push.
I think that is very interesting. China's growing at, they say, 4%, and that's a catastrophe for China. Mm-hmm. And in a sense it is, but we would love to have that growth rate in the United States. China's just used to growing at 8-9% a year, and they've done that for over a decade. And part of it is they have a couple of hundred million people in the backwoods of China that are moving to the cities and they need that kind of growth. And as you said, when that growth isn't there, they're not getting that 7% growth. They do have a lot of discontented individuals that are seeing life in the West and are seeing prosperity, and they want those things. And let's not forget, Jeremiah, that Asia, you know, because of its one-child policy, or China, because of its one-child policy, has a lot of military-aged men in China that are dissatisfied. They have no prospects of getting married, and they're there, and there's a lot of social issues that are related to that.
You know, one other thing that I'd like to bring into it, you were talking about these artificial islands that it's creating, but you also have to look at America's withdrawal setting China up for the way that it's treating its neighbors, the way that it's treating the Philippines, the way that it's treating Taiwan. If you look at where we are today, relative to a year ago, the world really has changed in the sense of seeing a more aggressive China. All of these neighboring nations around China are having to adjust their foreign policies in the wake of the reality of an American retreat and a Chinese advancement.
I'm really glad you brought that up. Just 2 days ago, we saw Japan and South Korea.
And 2 days ago.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. Just last week, we saw Japan and South Korea have a landmark meeting that people have been pushing for about 70 years now. And this is when Japan finally apologized to South Korea that to a degree that was deemed sufficient to most South Koreans for the slaves, the Korean slaves that Japanese soldiers had in the lead up to and during World War II. And I think we're going to see more of those sorts of moves. Japan and South Korea hate each other, but they're so afraid of America's declining presence. They see America as an unreliable ally. So they say, you know what, I would love to keep this hatchet unburied. I would love to maintain this grudge. And the last thing I want to do is ally with you, my you know, arch enemy in some ways. But since America is declining, Tokyo and Seoul are having to bury that hatchet. And I think a lot of nations are forming small alliances with each other. They're working toward partnership on various economic and even military platforms just to be ready for the U.S. to be totally out of the picture, because America has proven itself to be an unreliable ally, and now we're seeing just that reverberations of that all through Asia.
It reminds me a little bit of what we were talking about last week with respect to Europe and just how much the political necessities, because of the crises that are facing Europe, they're driving nations to give more power to Germany, where if they were just viewing it in isolation, they would say, we don't want a powerful Germany. We've seen what happens when we have a powerful Germany. And yet the alternative is worse. And it's almost like the more that you see these big events that are driving geopolitics today, the more surprising the headlines become, the more you're seeing, you know, the unprecedented alliance between two former enemies and that type of thing. And that is definitely driving events in Asia in a powerful way.
Yes. Yeah, I would say that's in some ways the number one story in Asia is just America's retreat. And that's the story all around the globe. The retreat of America from the Middle East, from, you know, Europe, from Asia, it's really acting as a catalyst to just about every trend we're watching for.
Well, you tell me there's no pivot to, what happened to the pivot to Asia? Wasn't there something called a pivot to Asia?
Well, you know,
what was that all about?
The way that you set up the point that Russia and Asia, Russia and China are emboldened because of America's withdrawal, it's also setting up this cooperation between them, and the relationship between Russia and China is really quite a lot more advanced than it was, say, at the beginning of 2015.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Ever since the Western nations, I mean, I would say it goes back even a little bit before 2015 that it really congealed, but it started with the annexation of Crimea. That's when we saw this Russia-China axis really jump into a new gear of almost total solidarity between these two nations. Because when Russia took Crimea, the West was fairly unified in condemning that move. They said this is 19th century kind of behavior that Putin is doing in the 21st century. And a lot of Westerners stood up and said, Putin, you just made enemies with the entire world. The entire international community is against you in this.
Minus the however many billions of Asians that there are.
Exactly. Well, that's what happened right after that. China came out and said, no, we don't condemn Putin for this. We understand that Russia had interests in Ukraine. They had, you know, there were populations of ethnic Russians on the peninsula there. And anyway, China made clear that they supported Russia, and then India did the same thing. So,
well, of course, China's going to. They have populations of ethnic Chinese in Taiwan.
Oh yeah,
right. I mean, it's the same kind of thinking between both of these empires. You can see why they would be aligned.
It sets a precedent that China could very well take advantage of in the future. So that could have been a big part of the reason why they supported Putin.
So, Jeremiah, you've given us the biggest change, how the world is different today than it was a year ago. What's the biggest change we should watch for in the time ahead?
Well, looking ahead to 2016, I think the main thing we can expect is just for Russia and China to be even more ambitious and even more willing to take major risks than they were in 2015. And that is largely because they believe time is not on their side. These nations see that at present, Europe is fractured, it's disunited. The European nations could not present a unified front against Russia or against China. But they also see that suddenly European defense budget is on the increase after years and years of it declining. They see that far-right parties are suddenly gaining all kinds of momentum that they couldn't have dreamed of having had 10 years ago. So Russia and China likely see that this fractured Europe is something that's temporary. They don't know how long Europe is going to be this way. And then the other aspect of time not being on their side is the fact that they know that President Obama only has one more year in office. And so after January of 2017, the situation with America being a total pushover in terms of foreign policy, that could drastically change. They believe that if someone like Donald Trump or Cruz or Rubio or someone became the next president, then this season when America refuses to really support its allies in the way it traditionally has, this time when America is just so weak-willed in terms of foreign policy, they think that that season could quickly end in January of 2017. So for that reason, I think that over these next 12 months, we could see just more and larger pushes from Russia and China.
That is such an important point. I'm really glad that you brought that up, because it is interesting to contemplate how much the reality of U.S. presidential politics could be a driver of events over this coming year. Knowing that the president who is in office right now, and really this is a perfect transition into our next segment about Anglo-America, and we'll probably talk more about this as we go, but how many nations are there in the world who have watched this president and just followed his actions in so many different areas around the world, watched America's foreign policy, and have a pretty good sense of just how insular he is, how devoted to domestic concerns he is, how uninterested he is in maintaining America's presence in these other nations, taken advantage of that, seized the opportunity, taken their bold moves, moved their troops into this theater or that theater, and really taken advantage of the opportunity that they've had while it's been there. What are they going to do now that they know that the clock is ticking, that the time is running out on this administration? Very interesting to contemplate, and we'll be definitely watching for that as we look ahead at what happens in the world in this coming year. So Jeremiah has written the thoughts up that he's shared with us in an article, How the World Changed in 2015 in Asia. You can look for that on thetrumpet.com. Coming up, we're going to turn our attention to how events in America changed the world. We'll be back in a moment.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
This is a special program about how the world changed in 2015. We've been taking things region by region. Last week, we talked about the Middle East and Europe, just now about Asia. Our final major segment here is about how events in America over this past year have changed the world. Now, in a way, America has been a major character in the picture in all of these regions. As we've been going region by region, America has been, I mean, it really is changes in America that have affected all of these different regions. We're going to focus directly on it now, though. Robert, you have 8 minutes or so to tell us the answer to the burning question. What was the biggest change within America over the past year?
Okay, this is an extremely difficult question to answer because there has been so much change in America this year. I mean, this was the concept that President Obama campaigned upon in both of his elections, change. And America got a lot of it in 2015. You can think about President Obama beginning to normalize relations with Cuba. United States was adopting all kinds of radical environmental regulations that are starting now to impact the economy. The International Monetary Fund, the Bank for International Settlements, had big warnings for America, economically speaking. We'll talk more about that later. Many of America's closest allies went out of their way to embrace China. We talked about the Asian Infrastructure and Investment Bank. Federal debt is on track to hit $20 trillion by the time President Obama leaves office. Don't forget about the military and how women are now allowed to serve in all roles in the military, combat units, special forces. There was changes from the Supreme Court in terms of the definition of marriage. And then just economically speaking, we're living in a world of $35 oil now in the United States. Gold is down, copper's down, silver's down, wheat, sugar, pretty much everything's down in America. Stock market is flat. Only thing up is the dollar. But in terms of these big stories, I want to talk a little bit just to begin with about the economy, because there are some very big events that happened just recently in past weeks, and that is the Federal Reserve finally raised interest rates. This is the first rise in interest rates in 7 years. Past 7 years, we lived in an environment of zero interest rates. Interest rates have not gone up in 9 years in America. We have investment analysts. We have people on Wall Street, their whole professional lives have existed only in an era of declining and falling interest rates. And now we are entering in, the Federal Reserve says, a new era. And the question is, what is going to happen to the American economy? And over this past year, it gives us some pretty big hints of what we can expect in the future. We've seen debt billow beyond what anybody probably even imagined a couple of years ago. I already mentioned federal debt at $20 trillion, but we're seeing corporate debt, personal debt. If we look at mortgages, credit cards, car loans, student loans, all of them up huge this year in the United States. There's not a type of debt in America that has gone down. And that is a factor of interest rates set by the Federal Reserve at 0%. We're seeing that. We're seeing corporate
debt markets over the last couple of months start to have serious trouble. People are looking at that and wondering if there's another Lehman Brothers ready to blow up. So the question is, are we in a debt bubble? And this year we had warnings from the International Monetary Fund and from the World Bank. The IMF said that another crisis is coming. Be prepared. It's coming. It's only a matter of time. These policies that the Federal Reserve and other central banks have adopted have delayed the day of reckoning from the 2008 economic crisis, but they're coming. So that is something for us to be aware of and look forward to. The Bank for International Settlements, they came out and said, look, we know there's a crisis coming. The lifeboats have all been used. Be prepared, because when the next crisis hits, we don't know how central banks will be able to handle it next time. Something else we drew attention to this year was the Davos Economic Summit. This is something that Gerald Fleury brought a lot of attention to. And the IMF at that point came out and was warning about the shadow banking sector. This is that sector that is not regulated by the bodies in the United States. And a lot of the new laws that came down after 2008 that caused the banks to change their lending practices, their investing practices. Well, all of that has just moved off books now into the shadow banking sector, these non-technically bank institutions. And now a lot of authorities are saying that there's a lot of areas where these bubbles are lurking and people need to be aware of it. Things are less stable than ever. And I think that really does characterize the financial markets in America. Stability, volatility. We talked about the fear index just exploding. That was a couple of months back. The most volatile days in the market that America had ever experienced up to this point in its history. So there's a lot going economically in the United States. We won't even talk about currency wars starting to erupt because of the strong dollar and other weak currencies out there.
You're talking about this is a potentially catastrophic economic crises that are looming right over the horizon for the United States. There's probably half a dozen of the things that you just mentioned that could absolutely decimate America's economy. Now, if I'm understanding you correctly, I asked you the biggest change in America for 2016, and you just listed all of these different ways that America is financially far worse off than it was even a year ago, but this isn't the biggest change.
No, you're right. And that, if we want to characterize this year, I think we could characterize 2015 in the United States as just one more year of probably the most destructive administration in U.S. history. So let's talk a little bit about how government has changed. Some of the things that have come down the line this year that have radically changed how America operates. Just recently, this past month, Congress, this gives a pretty good idea of how this administration operates. Congress, in conjunction with the White House, just passed the law giving the IRS the authority to revoke your passport if you don't pay your taxes. I mean, this is a dramatic increase of power given to the IRS. Now, this is just typical of a lot of the of things right down that line that have happened this year in the United States. The Environmental Protection Agency, given huge new powers this year, the power to regulate carbon dioxide emissions, what we live and breathe, what plants use to grow. The EPA gaining much more authority over the water bodies that it governs. What defines a navigable river? Well, the EPA says it's wetlands and marshes now. Their authority has greatly expanded in that regard. Oppressive government, big government, growing government, I think has been a trend this year that we saw in 2015. Another one that's very important that we can't not talk about is the attack on the traditional family. As I said, this is a big year for people trying to redefine what family is and what marriage is in the United States. The Supreme Court said in June that the Constitution guarantees the right to same-sex marriage, right? Since then, since that time, we've seen just a radical transformation, a revolution, you could say, that has just been pushing the boundaries of what marriage is, traditional moral values in the United States. We saw that same month that the Constitution gave its ruling that Bruce Jenner came out and he said he wanted to be known as Caitlyn, you know, after his surgery that took place. Just around that same time, there was a story about Rachel DeLisle, that African-American who said, you know,
although she's not African-American, she's Caucasian, but she says she's African-American, and that we should accept her as that because that's what she feels. So this is kind of all part of this trend that we saw in America where facts don't matter, genetics don't matter. What matters is what you feel you are on the same time. And we saw even a push to make pedophilia mainstream, much more mainstream. You know, those arguments that pedophilia is genetic, the same arguments that we saw being used to legitimize, you know, homosexuality and other things in the past. So we saw attacks on the traditional family. We saw the Planned Parenthood story this year, trafficking baby parts. We saw America's crumbling religious landscape, just how fewer and fewer people think religion is important in the United States.
I'm glad you're drawing attention to these things because they tend to sneak up on us. And even when they're huge changes, I mean, you're talking about some radical changes as far as America's historical view of and perspective on the family, on morality. These are massive, and yet we really easily forget, you know, all of these things that you just mentioned. This is just over the past 12 months. Where are we now relative to where we were a year ago just with our morality? And we've taken these on board. We've accepted this as the new normal. These kinds of stories where we're really undermining traditional values and the way that we've looked at these things for generations and millennia, suddenly they're different. And we can't forget that.
Yeah, 2015 was a year where just so much really, really changed. And as I said, it was very hard to narrow down to what was the biggest story for America this year. I mean, family, that's the bedrock of a nation. And that's been redefined this year by the Supreme Court, the supreme authority of the land of the United States. But as dramatic as that is, I think probably the bigger story this year, the one that 2015 will be remembered for even more, is how race relations have deteriorated in the United States. Think about, you know, the Michael Brown, the Baltimore riots, the Tamir Rice, Freddie Gray, Black Lives Matter, you know, and the Charleston shootings that happened down there, the killings that happened. I mean, 2015 was loaded with racially charged events. It was one event after another after another. And you know, the sad thing about it is so much of it really could have been avoided. Had the leadership of the United States come down the way it should have, the way that the facts have since played out on these cases, so much of this could have been avoided. But instead of that, 2015 was a year that it seemed like the administration went out of its way to discredit police forces and to justify a lot of these race baiters, a lot of these people behind the Black Lives Matters movement and a lot of the Al Sharptons of the world, the Jesse Jacksons of the world. I mean, we had a president this year who went out and told the nation that racism is in white people's DNA. I mean, that was a very dramatic, a very powerful statement by the president of the United States of America. I mean, think about what that means. Think of the implications of that. And then you wonder why race is so charged in the United States. What a terribly destructive message. We had a Justice Department going out of its way to find evidence of racism. In 2015, the catchword was disparate impact. And this was going out there and finding, you know, supposed evidence of racism. If more Black people are being arrested, if more Black people are being charged with crimes, that are out of proportion to their population, well, that is disparate impact. That's evidence of racism. You know, it doesn't consider things like, you know, alcohol abuse is higher in the Black community, broken families are higher in the Black community, things like that, that would be factors that would be causing these things. All it is about is disparate impact. We saw that in the schools. The education department, pushed by President Obama's administration, is looking for disparate impact among suspension rates and grades and all these things. And what we saw this year was the undermining of authorities in the United States, police authorities, educational authorities, and we saw it in a way that validated a lot of the Black Lives Movement type messages, and it just wasn't true. And as the court cases have proceeded and the juries have decided not to indict various officers, we've seen where the facts have come down, who was correct in a lot of these cases, and we found an administration on the wrong side of the issue.
You know, one of our most popular pieces of literature over the last couple of years is America Under Attack by Gerald Fleury, this booklet that explains the spiritual dimension to what is going on with this current administration and why it is that so many of the trends that you're talking about have been encouraged, if not directly caused by the administration in power right now. The United States has become a fact of life, almost everyday life. The headlines that we see, the trends that we see developing in the United States continually tracing back to this desire for radical change within this nation. That booklet explains why that's the case. It really gives an explanation that if you're just looking at it, there's just a whole lot of people who are watching this, very concerned about what has happened to this country, very concerned about many of these changes, and yet not understanding really why, really trying to do everything that they can to explain it and to unriddle what is going on in the mind of this president and his administration. But that really pinpoints it. And I think all of these trends that you're talking about, it really does show the power in that analysis, I think. You know, it's without that spiritual understanding, you really can't understand what's happening and why it's happening.
You're absolutely right, and I do encourage all our listeners to go to the website and download that book, because it will change, as you said, how you understand events and why they are taking place in America and the motivation behind what's going on in the United States today.
Stephen Fleury gave a Trumpet Daily program last week where he was just going through a bunch of the events of 2015. He had that montage at the beginning of the program where he had quotes from all these different politicians and actors all over the world and highlighting some of these things that have happened. The point that he made in that program that I thought was just absolutely dynamite was, at what point would our leaders ever acknowledge that what they're doing is failing, that it's not working? It's amazing to me to listen to this administration, in the face of so much evidence to the contrary, absolutely refuse to acknowledge that anything that it is doing is anything other than completely glorious and wonderful for the country. Looking at something like race relations and the discussion that keeps on coming up, that we need to get this out into the open, we need to talk about this, the more that that happens, the more problems it creates, the more anger and hostility there is, the more violence that you see in the streets. It's not solving anything. I mean, it really is not solving anything, as well-intentioned as they may be in trying to bring this out into the open, and I think that's very suspect. Just look at the evidence. Look at the fruits. Look at what's happening as a result. At what point do you say, you know what? Never mind. This isn't working. It was actually better before we started to try to fix this.
Polls show that out too. I think most Americans, a lot of Americans, realize that. But like you said, so much with our leaders today, when things aren't going the direction that they would hope, their answer is because we haven't been radical enough. We haven't pushed it enough. You know, whether it's economically, you know, we need more socialism, we need to spread the wealth, we need to tax more. Whether it's, you know, family relations or race relations, it's, you know, we need to push the envelope further down the line. And I think, you know, it gets into this. That's why it can be so destructive. And that's why 2015 was so destructive.
You mentioned this attack on the traditional family, which I think is just one of the most sobering trends underway in America and in Britain and in Canada and Australia. Bruce Jenner, of course, said that he wants to be known as a woman. He feels like one. And so the world says, yes, you're a woman. And then Rachel Dolezal, she feels like an African-American, so many people recognize her as one. Well, there was also a man in Canada named Paul Washt, a 52-year-old Canadian, father of seven, but he recently realized that he's not actually a 52-year-old man. He's actually a 6-year-old girl. And so he's maybe the first transgender and trans-ager that we've had. And a family in Toronto there adopted him as a 6-year-old girl. Said, we'll take this 52-year-old man into our home, treat him like, just enable this destructive delusion and perversion. It's almost too silly to even talk about, but it's a sign of just how diluted a lot of our family values have become.
Well, and how much the world has changed. Because you're talking about how do you get to the point where a family adopts a 52-year-old man who thinks he's a 6-year-old girl? You need about 10 or 20 social developments that are away from what works and what is real and what is normal to get to that point. And we've seen it all. I mean, it almost all happened just in the last 12 months.
And how do we get to the point where so few people are willing to stand up and say, this is wrong, this is not right? No, genetically speaking, you are a male, therefore you're a male and you'll use a man's bathroom.
Or, you know, why is it that that person who stands up and says that, he's the bigot, he's, you know, or whatever it is, he's a racist or he's a sexist or whatever it is. I mean, that's how, if you're looking at America today and you don't think America has changed over these last several years, you really need to sit down and take a look at what America is today compared to what it was when you were growing up, the America that you remembered, because it has changed. And I think it is a wake-up call for many people, but it's a wake-up call that you need, if you haven't had, you need to have that wake-up call, because America is changing. This is not the America of your grandparents. This is not the America of your parents. These last several years have been revolutionary for America, and 2015 was one more year on that path.
Well, I tend to think that there would be few who would argue that it hasn't changed. I think the argument would be over whether it's changed for the good or changed for the bad. And the ones who say that it's changed for the good, I think it really is a failure to acknowledge the results and a failure to see the reality of the effects that these changes are having.
Just another quick comment on the effect of America's moral decline on other nations. Even if you look at some African nations, they've received comments from the United States that you should improve your human rights,
embrace homosexuality, embrace same-sex marriage,
and then they just look at the United States as just ridiculous. Who should listen to the United States? Look at their morals. We cannot take America seriously anymore. And you have all this hypocrisy going on with all these nations, and you cannot solve anything because you tell them something they need to work on, and then they'll just slap back and just say, look at yourself, look at your moral decline. We are not going to listen to you because of this.
No, sometimes they really think twice about it because America puts their foreign aid on the line. It's like, if you're not going to change your human rights, you're going to not get the foreign aid from our country.
Making it even worse, right? They're right. Actually imposing it. They are imposing it on those countries.
Well, I think it's a valid point to ask, how much has that moral decline actually impacted America's effectiveness in terms of its foreign policy and its legitimacy, or its moral standing within these other nations? And how much has it impaired it, or how much has it caused these other nations to say, we're just not going to listen to the United States? You know, all of these factors that we're talking about, we really have been focusing. We focused on economy, and we're focusing on these domestic issues. But again, just to remind everyone, everything else that we've been talking about, it's how America's decline has impacted its standing in the world, and how many different factors there are, or how many events and trends that we're seeing in the world are stemming from that American decline. And you see it in theater after theater. The Middle East is being completely revolutionized because of America's decline. Europe is having to step up and take care of its own business in a way that it has not since the founding of NATO. Asia is changing radically because of the American pulling out of that arena. So it's a fascinating scenario to watch this play out both within the United States and globally. Now, just with that in mind, Robert, do you have any thoughts on the big change that we can watch for in this coming year?
Well, I think you could probably quote the president if you want to look at what's going to happen next year. He said in an email to his supporters, I think this was yesterday or last week or maybe a week and a half ago, he said, quote, "I've got 12 months left to squeeze every ounce of change I can while I'm still in office." So I think that's what we can expect going forward. These policies that have defined 2015 will continue to be the policies that define 2016, only pushed more to the extreme because this is President Obama's last year in office. He doesn't have a whole lot to lose, and I think he's going to push, and his supporters want him to push. So we'll just see more of what we had this year, except probably more of it.
You know, and then the one other thing, I think we just to bring back in Jeremiah's point about how much are the other nations in the world going to change their policies? How much are they going to change their course of action based on the brevity of President Obama's final months in office? And they just don't know what the next president is going to be like. What's the political scene in the United States going to look like after he's out of office? There's a whole lot of uncertainty. You look at a personality like Donald Trump, and I don't think there'd be too many people who would You know, they just don't. He's such a wild card. What would happen were he to take office? Now, what's interesting, and well, I'll just give you the opportunity to make this point, Jeremiah. You, as we were talking about this beforehand, you were just saying we know something they don't.
Yes. Yeah. Well, we know because of the sure word of Bible prophecy that it doesn't matter who becomes the president of America, whether it's you know, Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or Rubio or Cruz. America is declining, and it is on the way out. But these other nations don't know that. They think that if someone who is hawkish is elected, that there could be a real change in foreign, you know, in the foreign policy of the U.S. So because of that, I agree with the assessment that we've just heard that 2016 could be a big year for those nations just kind of pushing against the global order.
We've got a lot to keep our eyes on in the months ahead. Robert's written these thoughts about America up in an article called How the World Changed in 2015 in America. You can look for that on thetrumpet.com. After the break, we'll finish today's program with a look at some of the changes in this work in 2015. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
We're going to conclude the show today with a brief look about how this work has changed in 2015. I have our social media manager, David Vigil, with us to give us some year-end insights. Hello, David.
Hi. Thanks for letting me back on yet again.
We're going to talk about thetrumpet.com. Obviously, Trumpet Hour is the voice of the Trumpet magazine, and thetrumpet.com is our home online. So how's the website doing? How's it performed this year compared to last year?
Well, thankfully, it's performing better this year than last year. We have a 17% increase in the total number of users who are coming to our website. I've looked at the...
So users, not just page views, but the people.
Yes, the people. The people.
That's what we want, the people.
We do want the people there. And that's a really strong increase. It averages about 140,000 users per month. And there's some strong growth there. a lot of that is from mobile as well. So,
and how did what did you do, say, in your department in order to draw a greater audience?
So one of the things that we did last year, first time, was to consistently advertise our videos on YouTube. So specifically, that's the Trumpet Daily video, and then that's the Key of David video. And that has produced some wonderful results for us on the videos. Most of that traffic, even that, just goes to YouTube. So, you know, even the growth that we have from the users is only a partial benefit from the advertising that we send people to YouTube. So, but that does help. And we've seen some great growth there on our subscribers in YouTube. They're up 282%. Our total views on YouTube are up 164%. We've had over 7,000 pieces of literature requested directly from a YouTube video, whether Key of David or Trumpet Daily, last year. So that's just some really great data. Last year, we had three videos that actually broke over 200,000 views. That was two from the Key of David, Mystery of the Two Trees, and then How to Solve Race Relations, and then the Trumpet Daily video, King Hezekiah's Seal Impression Found.
And do you have any sense of how many of the people who are watching the YouTube that actually do make it to the Trumpet site or go on to, say, take a greater interest in more of our written material?
That is a good question. For the most part, most of those people just stay on YouTube. The way the analytics work, it's very hard to tie down exactly what goes on there. But one of the things that we track is to see how loyal the audience is, if we can actually get them to come back more. And we noticed with the Key of David, for example, we did have some stats there that show that people are coming back for more. Those few people who do come to the website to order literature, generally they see more pages in their visit than the average Trumpet.com user, and they spend more time on there. So the people that we can track, I think it's about 2% of the overall traffic. It's very small, but they do tend to explore more, spend more time on, which is a good sign. It just shows that we are interesting them with some information there.
All right. Well, thanks for that picture, David. I hope this coming year is even more successful than the last. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. This program is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. You can find us online at thetrumpet.com. That's where to find the stories that we talked about on the program today, and also where you can go to get a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. I want to thank my guests today, Brent Noctegal, Robert Morley, Jeremiah Jacques, Anthony Chibadewe, Richard Palmer, and David Vigil.
You're very welcome.
Honored to be here.
Great to be here.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with this thought from Louis L'Amour. There will be a time when you believe everything is finished. That will be the beginning. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world. We'll be right back.